Boston, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up, our week in review, but first, efforts to strengthen gun laws here in Massachusetts. This week, Colorado saw gun rights advocates lead a successful recall election to oust two pro-gun control lawmakers. But here in Massachusetts, which has some of the toughest gun laws in the nation, a pro-gun control governor wants even tougher laws.
Today, Governor Deval Patrick was one of many on Beacon Hill pushing for significant additions to the state's gun regulations. Joining us now in the studio to talk about this is WBUR's Fred Bever. Hi, Fred.
Hello, Sasha.
And Fred, what kinds of new restrictions on guns are on the table?
Well, there's a big range. It has to be a big table. It goes from tightening access to high-powered rounds, creating stiffer penalties for possession of legal firearms or using them in a crime, allowing private gun sales to be made only at the location of a licensed dealer to try to tighten up the ability of to create background checks even with private sales. One proposal that was popular with gun control supporters today was the idea of requiring gun owners to take out liability insurance in case their weapon ends up being used in a crime.
And as Anthony just pointed out, Massachusetts already has gun laws that are among the strictest in the country. So how is the governor framing his pitch for even tougher rules?
Well, part of it is in the wake of the Newtown tragedy, and one of the a mother of one of the young victims was there at the State House today and met with the governor, and that's really driven a lot of what's going on here. The governor says that the state has already done a lot to curb gun violence, including efforts by his administration to implement programs to curb youth violence in particular. But he also says it's not enough.
But there is more we can do and therefore should do to make the consequences of illegal gun ownership and illegal gun use more significant. This is not about taking away anybody's rights. This is about affirming everybody's right to live in safety and without fear of violence.
Fred, what about supporters of gun rights? What are they saying about these proposals?
Well, they were out in force, and they generally resist what they see as limitations on the constitutional right to bear arms. But there does seem to be some common ground to be found in the State House, particularly around mental health issues, which caught the public's attention after the Newtown shootings. It's an issue here because Massachusetts is only one of seven states that does not provide mental health commitment status to a federal database that's used to determine eligibility to buy a firearm. Just six others are in that position. State privacy laws appear to prevent it now, but even gun rights groups say that needs to change, and I think you'll see movement on that in the legislature, maybe even before the end of this year. There were some complaints today that the state's gun licensing bureaucracy is too slow. Here was Grafton Representative George Peterson noting that with license applications up this year, wait times are too.
The state is supposed to turn around these applications in 40 days. Not 40 months, not 6 months, not 9 months, 40 days. And I'm going to pay the penalty of a state that cannot get its job done, even though...
In terms of the process from here on, is the governor expected to sign a piece of legislation soon?
Well, there are 65 bills that this committee, the Public Safety Committee, is contending with. They hope to get their work done within a month. But House Speaker Robert DeLeo said today that he wants them to wait until a task force that he assigned comes out with its report. That was supposed to come out last month. We're still waiting for it. The governor is urging them to get something done soon and this year.
That's WBUR's Fred Bever, who was in the State House today for that testimony. Fred, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And with that, let's jump right into our week in review. With less than 2 weeks to the preliminary election, 12 candidates for mayor of Boston pushed to sharpen their differences and emerge from the pack. Governor Patrick and the legislature reverse course on the tech tax. And as we just heard, a new push for tougher gun control in Massachusetts. And joining us now, two members of our Week in Review team, Peter Canellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Peter, welcome back.
Thank you, Anthony.
Good to have you. And we have you on the phone today because we understand our line to the Boston Globe is out of commission, but good to have you just the same. And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute in Boston. Good to have you with us, Jim.
Good to be with you, too.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. Well, let's talk a little bit about gun control. We just heard Fred Bever talking about the latest effort on Beacon Hill to strengthen gun control measures. There are already pretty strong laws on the books. We heard the governor say more needs to be done. Peter, what's your thought on this? After months and months of talking about it, will the legislature get something done, do you think?
I think they will. It was good to hear in your report that there seems to be an emerging consensus on mental health issues. It's been frustrating that nothing has happened in that time. You know, people in Massachusetts take great pride in our commitment to gun control, but the one area where we're way behind the other states, including some of the states you associate with, the gun lobby is in reporting mental health commitments, and it's for an understandable reason. It's for not wanting to stigmatize people who have mental health histories, but it's very hard for Massachusetts to preach to other states about gun control if you're one of only seven that does not report to the registry people's commitments for mental health.
Mm. So, Jim, is that a good place to start, or what's your view about the debate on Beacon Hill around gun control?
Well, I'd say that the place to start is mental health. I think we've seen in many other states they've been further ahead of us. I think that in terms of the gun control laws that we currently have, we do have a number of them. I think what Representative Peterson was talking about in terms of the timing to get gun licenses and stuff like that, we do need to make progress on that as well to respect gun rights. But we do need to make some progress in terms of mental health, and I do think there is consensus on that issue.
Hmm. As we mentioned also in the intro to this piece, gun rights advocates really flexed their muscles in Colorado. They led a successful recall election of two pro-gun legislators. Very different picture here in Massachusetts, but I'm wondering if what happened in Colorado in any way could affect what goes on here in Massachusetts in this regard. What do you think, Peter?
Well, the Gun Owners Action League in Massachusetts, which is the local branch of the NRA, is hardly a quiet, impotent force. I mean, there are strong pro-gun rights voters and advocates here in Massachusetts. So it would not surprise me at all if a certain number of legislators are, politically concerned about taking a stance in favor of gun control.
Yeah, what's your view on that, Jim?
I was just out in Colorado, and in fact was out there during a time when there were rallies all over the place. And I would say that, no, it won't happen here. Yeah. And the reason it won't happen here is the kind of reaction that you get from hunters and folks who are actually in very rural areas. It's just not something you find as much here. It doesn't carry the kind of clout that you would need to get something done here. So yes, it will affect a few legislators, but not to the extent that it does in Colorado.
Finally, and quickly, I'm wondering what both of you think about make of Governor Patrick continuing to push this issue in his final term in office. Jim, does this say anything about his future political ambitions, or what do you make of that?
I don't think so. I think this is one that the governor actually feels really strongly about. Mm. He's talked about it throughout his time in office. At the time of the Newtown, frankly, the disaster that happened there, he was very forthright in talking about the need to do more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Peter, what do you make of it?
I would say the same. I mean, obviously, he has a personal commitment to gun control. The fact that Newtown happened in a neighboring state is something that shocked the conscience of Massachusetts. So there's plenty of justification for it, but it is part of a larger plan by the Democratic Party on the federal level and in various states to try to make the gun control issue one that works for them in the 2014 elections.
Peter Kanellis and Jim Sturgis, a switch in topic to the state's apparently doomed tech tax, which is turning into one of those cases of lawmakers voting for it before they voted against it. So lawmakers passed this tax in July. It was part of the transportation financing package. But there was huge backlash from the business and tech community. And so now the governor and Therese Murray and Robert and Bob DeLeo, leaders on Beacon Hill, say it has to go. Here is House Speaker DeLeo earlier this week.
There were folks from the industry and many folks in the business community, some of which are here today, who expressed a grave concern. A grave concern that we were sending a message to the innovators across this country and across the world, for that matter, that Massachusetts may not be the place to be.
And Jim, if many lawmakers now are saying this is a bad idea, why did they pass it in the first place?
It's a great question. We were supportive of additional revenue for transportation during the early part of the debate. We believe it should come through user fees, through gas taxes, because that's the best way to actually create the kinds of incentives you want for fuel-efficient cars and to make sure that people who are using the system are paying for it, that sort of thing. The governor actually proposed this in his initial blueprint, which is surprising that he would come out strongly and say it's not right. A couple other thoughts on this. I think this is as much about the upcoming legislative and gubernatorial races as it is about anything else, and that is going into a race and having a big tax issue, potentially even a referendum item on the ballot, is just not something that Democrats want to see. I'd say a couple other things. One is, look, the tech industry was asleep at the switch on this from the beginning. Frankly, back in the spring when we were highlighting, no, you don't want to go that route. You really want to take the route of, if anything, gas taxes, but really you want to take the route of reform. They were silent I was really surprised by that. And that's an industry. The tech industry is one that is sore because most of the incentives that have come out for industries, whether clean tech or biotech, excluded them. So they feel like they're not a favored child, if you will, in our endless list of sort of incentives for favored industries.
But once the industry got its act together and pushed back, it was an effective pushback.
Absolutely. And they pulled out all the stops.
Peter Kanellis, on the issue of legislators saying we weren't sure what the impact of this would be, we actually had Speaker DeLeo on the air yesterday saying we passed it before we had a full realization of the impact. Is the lesson here that lawmakers need to be reading bills more thoroughly before they vote for them?
Well, this was something that was buried in the governor's initial proposal, which I think the legislature would have been better off if it took it more seriously, the one that would have raised the income tax but also limited other taxes in a way to make the tax code more progressive. But they didn't choose that path, but they did find in the, you know, the tiny print of the governor's proposal this tech tax, which was not called a tech tax. It was an expansion of the sales tax to cover a form of services that's kind of on the line between a service and a purchase. And it was something that did disproportionately affect the tech community. You could tell that when looking at it, but it was I don't think that legislators felt like they were voting for something that would uniquely burden the one of the most promising areas of the economy. Mm. And I think once that became apparent, they realized they had really messed up.
Mm. Well, let's move on to the race for mayor of Boston, with a preliminary just a week and a half away. This race remains one that is difficult to analyze or predict. There are still 12 candidates there. Peter, your paper ran an interesting piece about this today, that even political insiders find it too complicated to call because, 20 years since the last truly competitive race, and during that time the city has really evolved dramatically in terms of ethnic representation. It's now a majority-minority population. So with that in mind, Peter, I'll start with you. Give us your thoughts about where this race stands today.
Well, I think this race has been a revelation in so many ways. I mean, we are seeing an emerging kind of consensus agenda for the city going forward, one that favors, you know, transportation-oriented development, that wants stronger reforms of the school system, that believes that we should try to leverage some of our world-class assets to draw in new businesses and to be a bigger player in the global economy. I think all of those issues have sort of come out of these very intelligent forums that have been conducted by all of these candidates. And precisely because we don't have an obvious front runner and the insiders don't know who to key on, there hasn't been negative campaigning. There hasn't been a lot of scandal coverage. It's been a very spirited, positive campaign focused on the issues. It's what voters always say that they want. So I think that the idea that we can't call it right now, and I'm not going to try to call it, is a wonderful blessing that we should enjoy for as long as we have it.
Really interesting. Jim Sturgis, one of the points I was going to make is I've been impressed, too. We've been slowly doing in-depth interviews with all 12 of these candidates, and I am struck by the level of substance in all of the conversations that we're having with these guys.
I completely agree, and it makes me proud to be someone from Boston rather than New York, because if you take a look at the race in New York, it was anything but that. We have a great group of candidates. They are young. They are smart. There's a deep bench. There are some people that we're getting to know that will be future leaders, and that all is good for the city. I would agree with Peter on the positive message, and I do think there is some consensus building there in terms of those three issues that he identified, and I would highlight especially education. It's mm-hmm. been the frontline issue from the start, and I would say in part that's because the BTU has not come out for a candidate. It's such a splintered field. They're unable to coalesce around a specific candidate. And I would say that look, the issue of charter schools, where, for example, in 2006, we saw that three of the four Democratic candidates for governor came out for charter schools. That was sort of a moment when things changed. It was no longer a political issue. And I think we're seeing that now in Boston, where so many of the top candidates are for charter schools. But they're also for other really important things. Like, they're also talking about the district office, Court Street, which eats up so many, consumes so many resources within our school system, and wanted to do reforms there. So they're intelligent conversations. Education is right at the start of all of them. But it's also a very positive message about what this city can become. We're actually a pretty I wouldn't say aggressive, but we are a very energetic city right now in terms of the political discussions.
There's also a lot of talk about New Boston versus Old Boston, or the city that Boston has become since the last time there was a truly competitive race. And which candidate can appeal to the Boston of today? We spoke to Representative Marty Walsh about his candidacy, about this very topic, earlier this week. And let me just play a little bit of that exchange. I'll be blunt here, but how does a white Irish Catholic guy from Dorchester make the case that he represents the new Boston?
I do it every day as a state representative. My district is 56% people of color. I've spent my whole career on Beacon Hill and as the head of the building trades, making sure that there's opportunities for everybody. We still have major divides in the city. I've seen that in this campaign, and we need to do better than that. I think the things I can do as mayor of the city of Boston is to make sure that the upper echelon of my police department reflects the city of Boston, making sure that the school department reflects the city of Boston, making sure that all of my cabinet-level positions, making sure it represents the city of Boston.
So, Peter, how do you think this question of race, of color, of changing Boston is playing out in this race?
I think it's playing out. It's playing out a little bit less than you would expect in terms of black versus white or identity politics of any sort. I think that there are a lot of white voters, including a lot of people in Mayor Menino's inner circle, that are eager to see a non-white candidate succeed Menino. On the other hand, I think there are plenty of people of color out there in the neighborhoods who have great loyalty to their city councilors who happen to be white. And I think that there's a real blending of issues, of cultures, of priorities among the candidates that's been a very, very positive thing. So I would not dismiss the idea that somebody like Marty Walsh can appeal to minority voters, but also present himself in a way as a new face for Boston, in the same way that somebody like John Barros or Charlotte Gola Ritchie can also claim part of Boston's history and legacy as their own if they were to become mayor.
Another issue that's come up is how active Mayor Tom Menino continues to be. Some of the candidates, including Marty Walsh and others, have urged him to slow down because they say the next mayor is going to have to live with a host of policy proposals and decisions that he's pushing right now, including a big plan for 30,000 new housing units. Meanwhile, the BRA has just approved major developments in the Back Bay and elsewhere. So some candidates are saying slow down, but here's Councilman Mike Ross, also a candidate for mayor, saying the mayor needs to carry on. Let's listen.
The mayor cannot stop doing his job. There are some people up here who are actually talking about disassembling the development agency of the city of Boston in the middle of a building boom. And my concern would be that we stall our economy. And we have to be very careful. We all have visions for this city about improving our schools, creating affordable housing. It won't happen if our economy stalls, and we better be really careful before we just say stop.
So, Jim, what do you think about this? Is Mike Ross right, or should Mayor Menino sort of slow down, given that he's only got a few months left before the election?
I think a couple things. One is he has stayed out for the most part. He hasn't put his thumb on the scale for a candidate, and I think that's also very good for us in terms of trying to understand who may win, unlike Bloomberg, again, New York City. I wouldn't say stay out, but I would say refocus. There are some huge issues out there the mayor's not focusing on. And one that I think was reported on by the Herald this week that I thought was really important was, look, we all remember the arbitration negotiations with the firefighters in 2010, and it ended up saddling the city with $74 million in back pay and $25 million in raises. If you play out the open contracts, the ones that have expired for firefighters and emergency medical services and for the Patrolmen's Association and others, you're talking about if we base it upon the precedent of 2010, you could have to settle up about $200, $225 million. Hmm. Any new mayor, we want to talk about New Boston, the new mayor needs to have some room to run, some resources to put into the schools to do the things that he or she may want to do. And I think that that would really hobble the city. So I would say to the mayor, go full steam, but finish the work you're supposed to do. Do not trace out an agenda that has a lead of 10 years. Finish what you have to do to make sure these folks who are coming in trust the younger generation.
Peter, let me get you in on that work that Mayor Menino should or shouldn't be doing in advance of the next administration.
Well, I think what concerned some people about the housing plan was two things. One is, you know, where has he been all these years with his plan for 30,000 new houses? You know, after 20 years, he's never been talking about taking on development challenges in the neighborhoods, which can be quite difficult because of local opposition. So now now, on the way out the door, he's sort of setting this high bar for the next mayor, 30,000 units, and this is how we're going to do it. So there was a little bit of chafe on the campaign trail at what is Menino saddling us with here. The other part of it is that this involves selling off some city-owned parcels of land, and I think that any of those kinds of transactions that are done in the 11th hour, there's a little bit of suspicion that there's some favoritism or, you know, rewarding of folks who've been loyal Menino supporters over the years. Just the risk of that. I'm not saying that the mayor is intending to do that, but we should be on the lookout for any kind of a last-minute deal that might not be in the city's interest.
Hmm. Peter and Jim, I'd like you both to weigh in on some news out yesterday, and that's the word that Intel, the world's leading maker of computer chips, will close its only factory in Massachusetts. That's in Hudson. And that means a loss of 700 manufacturing jobs, very likely good-paying manufacturing jobs. Intel says the Hudson plant is outdated. Now, manufacturing in Massachusetts has been shrinking over the years, of course, but it still represents an important piece of the local economy. How big a blow is this latest news from Intel to the two of you? Jim, you want to start us off?
At the human level, it's huge for the for Hudson in terms of what it means for the state of Massachusetts, which does have some huge issues. We've seen about a third of our headquartered businesses close down or leave the state over the last 20 years. This is a non-political issue. It cuts across all governors' tenures. We have not really grown a job in 20 years. That's deeply troubling. So that's all there, but this is not really related to that. This is an older plant that was actually used for older chips. They're only used in electronic devices. It's hard to retool a facility like that, and I would not expect they would. You're going to have 100 people who are going to be laid off over the next 3 to 4 months. You have all of them leaving by the end of 2014. That's a huge hit for Hudson. I would hope that Greg Bialecki and his team working for the state would move in immediately and start thinking about reuse opportunities, repurposing for that. I would also say it is, of course, an opportunity for us to go and look at how we can make manufacturing a much more attractive sort of business here. It's hard to do here. Our unemployment insurance system is one of the most generous and easy to be eligible for. It's very expensive. Our health care costs are through the roof, and we do have a regulatory environment that is pretty difficult. But that is not what Hudson is about.
Peter, anything quickly to add there?
Well, first of all, this is very high-end in manufacturing, so we have a huge asset with our educated workforce. So it is very dispiriting to see a company like Intel moving out. The thing that leaped out at me was Intel saying they might have considered retooling this plant, but they didn't have land to do so that happens to be where this plant is, which is probably sort of an accident that there's no room for expansion. However, in the Hudson area, in any place from in the Worcester area, in the Springfield area, whatever, there's plenty of land for expansion, and Massachusetts should really be on top of providing companies that do high-end manufacturing as much help as possible in finding new space, new headquarters, and hopefully avoiding some of these problems in the future.
And Peter and Jim, before we go today, we like to end, as you know, with what we call our weekly hubbub, some little bit of news that may have gone unnoticed or that we didn't get to talk about so far today. Peter, do you have one in mind?
Yeah, the sale of the Graves Island Lighthouse way out in Boston Harbor to a Newbury Street businessman who's talking about turning it into an inn, which would actually be quite a place, and also allowing the Boston Harbor Islands Alliance to run ferries out there at certain times, which could be fun. But it's part of a larger story of activating the Harbor Islands, which are a great resource, and we have to work harder to provide low-cost ferry service to the larger islands and access to islands like Graves.
And Jim Sturgeon?
Well, mine is the 2013 Ig Nobel Prizes, which were awarded this week, and there's lots that is truly ignoble about this. First is that there's a lot of pomp and circumstance. Actually, 1,100 people attended this in Harvard's historic Sanders Theater. That's one point. The second thing is they had real, live, breathing Nobel Prize winners giving out these awards. I'll give you an example of what some of them had come up with. Masataro Uchiyama and his team of Chinese researchers and Japanese researchers won an Ig Nobel Prize for assessing the effect of listening to opera on heart transplant patients who are mice. And another one by a Canadian team that's mixed with a British team, they won the probability prize for making two related discoveries. The first is that the longer a cow has been lying down, the more likely the cow will soon stand up. And second, that once a cow stands up, you really can't predict how soon that cow will lie down again.
They do these awards every year, and I love them. I noticed one this year was they prove that if you are drunk, you are more likely to believe that you're attractive. They call it the beauty is in the eye of the beer holder.
What I find truly ignoble about it is this is the 23rd annual one.
Exactly. Now, my hubbub this week has to do with the state Senate chambers having a new $82,000 microphone system. And to explain why that is, here's Senate President Therese Murray speaking during the formal session yesterday.
The old microphones were old, but the reason that they sometimes didn't work is because you keep food in your desks and the mice have eaten through the wires. So if you are going to keep food in your desks, it must be in a proper container that is sealed so the mice do not get in.
So there is an admonishment from the Senate president to her underlings. You have to put your food in Tupperware so the mice don't nibble through the wires, which they did.
All right. So here's my hubbub. I know there's a lot of excitement, justifiably so, around town for the Boston Red Sox, who have the best record in baseball, first place American League East, seem to be heading for the postseason. But I'm going to take a chance here and tip my hat to a great player for the New York Yankees. Mariano Rivera is going to be at Fenway Park possibly for the last time ever as an active player on Sunday. It's going to be the last regular season game. There's going to be a ceremony at Fenway Park, but truly a great player. 19 seasons, 651 saves, 13-time All-Stars, and by the way, more appearances at Fenway Park than any visiting reliever in the history of Fenway Park. So quite an accomplishment. I know there's this great rivalry with the Yankees, but Mariano Rivera is certainly one of the best. He's going to be here in Boston. So a tip of a hat to a Yankee. And that's it. Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, thanks so much for coming, and have a great weekend.
You too.
And Peter Canellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Peter, thank you as always. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Anthony.
And stay with us. Up next, an Italian art squad rescues a Renaissance masterpiece, and you can see it now at the MFA. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.